You're listening to Jewels and Bullets, the You and My discography podcast, a show where a You and My fan and a You and My super fan discuss each of the band's records. I'm Tommy Waite, an Aussie writer and podcaster who's based out of Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm the You and My fan in this equation. My co-host and You and My super fan is Sydney-based Jono Duncan, the host of the Progressive Rugby League podcast and general man about town. Jono, how the bloody hell are you?
Hey, Tommy. I'm really well. I'm pretty excited too. So let's get stuck in straight away. I'm so pumped.
Let's do this.
Can I just clarify? I am a super fan, but not the super fan. I just want to put a caveat out there, but very excited to be here.
Yeah, there is the super fan walking around, very proud somewhere of his title. And if you start trying to claim that from him or her, or they, then perhaps there might be an issue. So I'm glad you squared the ledger immediately. So today in episode one, we're talking sound as ever. The first LP from You and My from 1993. But before we get stuck into the record, a quick disclaimer. Myself and Jono are in no way affiliated to You and My. We're just two fans talking music for the love of the game. If you found this show, there's a good chance you're already familiar with the group known as You and My. But if not, listen to their records, go to their shows, send them all your money and love. They bloody deserve it. Anything to add, Jono? I'm not a trained lawyer, but I feel like that pretty much covers us from a legal perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. This show really is just a show of enthusiasm towards a band that we love and has given us a lot. So we hope to sort of just talk about the songs that we love and the stories behind it and our experiences growing up with UMI. That's where I'm coming from anyway. So I'm interested in how it's all unfolded for you too.
Amen to that. Sharing the love. So Format for the show will be what we're going to do in episode one. We'll give a quick bit of background on how myself and Jono became You and My fans. And then we'll go into Sound as Ever, a few notes on what led up to the recording of the record. Then we'll go through the record track by track. Finally, we'll talk a little bit about what happened after the album dropped. So that's pretty much the show. That'll be the format, unless something changes. So let's get stuck in. Jono, the ref's blown the whistle, mate. Tell me, how did you become a You and My fan?
Well, before I get to that, Tommy, I want to start with, just to extend on what I was saying before, and talk about what kind of fan I am. Because I, like I said, I'm not the super fan, but I am a You and My super fan. And I would say You and My are probably my favorite band. I don't like using that term because, you know, I'm not 12. And as I've grown older, there's, you know, heaps of bands that I think are amazing. But undoubtedly, they're the band that mean the most to me and the band that really kind of got me interested in music at a deeper level, I guess, and, you know, deeper than just singing along to the radio. So I would consider myself a super fan, not the super fan. There are people out there that would know a lot more than me about the band and have a lot more kind of musical savvy than me and get the linkages and references better than me. Like my knowledge of music is actually pretty limited, but to give listeners a sense of the kind of fan I am, you know, I'm kind of the guy where friends and family will text me when You and My or Timmy is in the news or on the radio or something. I'm obviously obsessed over their records, every single one of them, as well as all the equally brilliant Roger's solo collection, which we'll no doubt touch on throughout the series. So there's literally thousands of hours there. But perhaps most pertinently, the following anecdote might give you a sense of the kind of fan I am. So most blokes who have been through adolescence will tell you that the most embarrassing thing possible is to get caught by your dad masturbating, right? It's a horrific experience, but I would say these blokes have never had their dad catch them rocking out in their rumpus room with unlikely intensity, playing Rogers like air guitar, you know, a very specific type of movement full of expression and bounce, and using a doorknob as a microphone to kind of whisper, scream into. I can't actually do a rock scream, so it's always like a whisper scream. And so I should add, I'm legally an adult at this point. I'm probably 19 or 20. Maybe the Dress Me Slowly era. So I'm I'm here. I'm thinking I'm alone, just spasming all over the room. And of course, like sidling up to the doorknob at all the right moments. And then I catch out of the corner of my eye, my dad slowly backing his way out of the room with the most confused look on his beautiful Italian face. We've never spoken of it, but I've no doubt it was a source of awkwardness between us for months beyond that. So anyway, that little anecdote probably describes my UMI / Tim Rogers fandom. I feel it like not much else. So hopefully that gives listeners a bit of a sense. Perhaps I'll let you go into how you got into UMI from here, Tommy, and then I'll get into how I got into them specifically. But hopefully that kicks us off with the kind of fan I am.
I think that's definitely a good start. And, you know, let's be honest with the listeners up front, Jono. Jono does have 5 years on me. He's he's been walking around this God's good earth 5 years longer than I have. And I think that's important in relation to this podcast because the flimsy premise that I came up with when I was making a coffee the other morning was like, all right, Jono's a super fan. I'm a fan. Why is that? And I think it's got something to do with the half a decade he's got on me. Hear me out, folks. So I grew up in the early years of high school when you're kind of ripe for the picking in terms of some record executive in Los Angeles thinking, how the fuck am I going to get this kid's pocket money out of him? I came in when I was 13 or 14 to the kind of Rock is Back era, championed by the Strokes, the Vines, Jet, the Hives, the White Stripes. And it was honestly, when I think in relation to UMI, it was off the back of that got me into UMI because I started listening to all those bands. I was, ripe for the picking. It worked. Fell in love with those that music and those bands in that era. But then I recall, I think it might have been Jet or Craig Nichols from the Vines referencing UMI and saying how important they were. And so I recall it was one Christmas where a family friend were asking my parents, what should I get Tommy for Christmas? One of those situations where they were coming over for the second lunch on Christmas Day or whatever, and there was going to be some gifts exchanged. So, I said, I'll get me the cream and the croc because it was advertised at the time. And I'm ashamed to say they got it for me, and I wanted to like it, but it went over my head at the time.
Can I just ask, Tom? Did they get you the double album version or the single album version?
Oh, I got the cream and the croc. Nice. Yeah, good. I think they were a bit disappointed. They were like, fuck, $40 from Sanity just for a 5 out of 10 turkey dinner. Probably reheated. But anyway, so that was what first got me into it. And it was one of those situations where I really wanted to like it, but I think my musical palate wasn't that advanced yet. So that was kind of like me entering the realm, but it really was, I'd say Convicts was the record that grabbed me, because then that was like 6 or so years later, first year of university, I saw UMI perform live at Metro's Fremantle, pretty good live, pretty good venue for live music, and it was a great show and great record. It kind of that was kind of like a reawakening for them, I think. I guess we'll discuss that when we get to it. But anyway, at that point, I was like, oh, I'm in. And I get it. I get it now. My palate had advanced. And then I went back. I was so fucking happy I had that double album so I could go back and be like, oh, these are the hits. These are the kind of like the slightly different ones, but maybe better than the hits in some ways. And so from that point I was in, but I don't think they got their talons in me as early as your good self perhaps, or
well, I'm looking forward to when we get to that point of that Rock is Back era, because that was a really interesting time. So I guess we'll get to that point around sort of the Dress Me Slowly era. But for me, this will sound like I'm making this up, but honestly this is true. Hearing a UMI song in my brother's car when I was 15 years old changed the trajectory of my life. I really think it did. Now, the year was 1998, and so UMI had recently released their fourth album, the number four record. So similar to you, Tommy, I wasn't there from the beginning. And so they just released their number four record, but I was none the wiser. I really had no idea. I think I knew of them, but I wasn't in that world. How do I put this, Tommy? I grew up listening to commercial shock jock talkback radio. My folks loved the 2UE shock jockery, and it's embarrassing but true. But as a kid, I think I kind of loved it too. I think it was mainly the sport. I was obsessed with sport, but I listened to kind of anything and everything on that wacky station, and it truly was wacky, and it hasn't changed over these years. I think it's 2GB now. Anyway, and so that was the kind of audio I mainly consumed. And I also started listening to a bit of Triple M as I reached my teens. Like my cousin and my bro, they loved U2 and Dire Straits and stuff like that. So I guess from a musical perspective, that's kind of where I was at in my early teens. But this day in my brother's white Ford Laser Bubbleback was kind of the line in the sand from which I never crossed back from. It was all very gradual, of course, but I do think like that was a moment that changed my life in a way. I was in the 10th grade at school, doing work experience at a real estate agent in Carlingford in the burbs of Sydney. It's like a horrible last minute placement. And I was kind of feeling super down and I guess super sensitive. And my brother would have been about 20 and we were in his car. He was taking me to the real estate agent and he had Triple J Breakfast on. I think it was like Paul McDermott and Mikey Robbins, and I'd never really heard them. And then you and I came on with Heavy Heart on the radio. And it just hit my kind of wussy little heart out of the ballpark in a lot of ways. Like in a lot of ways, it's a very conventional song, but I'd never heard anything like it. It just felt like just the perfect song. I guess I was used to like a sheen in my music, I guess, from listening to big bands on Triple M. And then this song just came on. It just sounded so humble and sweet. And I don't think I've ever felt, to that point, I'd ever felt such a close proximity to a song. So it just kind of felt really up close to me. And so that song got me through that day and I sung it all day. And then from there, it was just a gradual process. My brother had that album at home and all the UMI albums to that point. So that was important. And at first, I'd just go downstairs where the stereo was in our house and just listen to Heavy Heart. And then I'd sort of expand just to listen to Heavy Heart and Rumble, which is the next song on that album. And then another song and then another song, until I got through the whole album. And then I went to Ali Daily, then Hi-Fi Away and Sound As Ever. So I basically went backwards from number four to get to Sound As Ever. And so through my love of UMI, I guess I became, a Triple J guy. They were the only ones playing them from what I could see at the time. And then I got into music more generally. And I guess I might have become the person I am with or without UMI, but you know, who knows? In my mind, that was the turning point. I don't know how it changed things, but to at least a decent extent, events unfolded the way they have for me, for better or worse, due to UMI.
There you have it.
There you have it.
Yeah, I could go off into a million tangents in terms of similarities, differences with the, you know, my kind of experience seeing them in Fremantle that time. But I think we're going to, all in good time. I think we're going to get there. But I think that gives a pretty good overview of where we're coming at this from. And I'm excited about this journey, man, because I'm going to be able to get this information that I need. You're the kind of fingers crossed. If you've actually been paying attention as opposed to just listening to Heavy Heart on repeat for the last 20 years, I'm going to be able to get kind of like the upgraded advanced version of Wikipedia here and be able to kind of get all the extra stuff. So let's start at the beginning. And obviously it isn't the beginning. There were EPs prior to Sound As Ever. And perhaps if this thing's a fucking raging success, we can go back and sideways into Rogers. Or I'm already thinking of the tangents and the side projects and all that. But to keep things very simple, we're just going to go through all the LPs in order. So we're not going to dwell too much on this because, let's face it, anyone who's listening to this is a UMI sad sack as well as much as us. So, but anyway, just kind of the bare bones details. It was released October 25, 1993. The label was Ra Records. It was recorded in rural Cannon Falls, Minnesota, over 8 days, from July to August 1993. So I guess the middle of the year, and then it came out, you know, like 3 or 4 months later. It was produced by Lee Rinaldo of Sonic Youth fame, with Wayne Connolly as mixer and audio engineer. And that name jumped out at me because he worked with the Vines. And I believe it was kind of like the Vines wanted him because he'd been attached with UMI. And yeah, it produced 3 singles, Adam's Ribs, Berlin Chair, and Jamie's Got a Gal. There's tons of stuff that anyone could wiki about this record. But in terms of kind of like the album coming together, super fan, Jono, do you feel like there's anything pertinent about kind of the formation of the band or the early EPs that's necessary that we discuss in relation to Sound as Ever?
Oh, look, not really. I guess we could just have a quick scene set of like you've given. We could probably say that, you know, UMI was born in 1989 in Sydney. There were 3 parents. There was Jamie Rogers, Tim's bro, on drums, I think, Nick Tischler on bass, and Tim, Jamie's bro, on guitar and singing. I think Mark Tunnelly replaced Jamie Rogers soon enough. I think that's when they released an EP, Snake Tide, before Andy Kent replaced Nick Tischler on bass. And I think there were 2 more EPs, Goddamn and Coprolalia, before Sound as Ever came out. So, and I will get to this towards the end of the show, but Mark Tunnelly departed as drummer of the band just before Sound as Ever was released, and Russell Hopkinson replaced them, and Rusty, Andy, and Tim were the trio for that band until the late 90s when Davey Lane joined them at their live album, Saturday Night Round 10. And from there, that's been the 4 of them. So that's a bit of a primer, but yeah, all on Wiki if you really need it. But I think that gives us a bit of context.
And one thing I was curious about, perhaps you know, how did they get hooked up with Rinaldo? Was it a kind of, were they hyping? I appreciate that you weren't following the band at the time, but like, have you ever found out, like, because this, it seems like he was kind of the perfect guy to record this album, and seems like somewhat of a coup for them to be able to, you know, because Rinaldo was recording Nirvana immediately prior to UMI coming in. So do you have any idea of kind of like what the UMI hype train was looking like after the initial EPs?
Yeah, like you say, I was a few years younger than my brother, who was the prime sort of generation for UMI fans. He was kind of like, born in the late 70s, I guess, so that age. So I was born in the early-ish 80s. So I wasn't around that point, but I've gleaned snippets over the years. So from reading, you know, the liner notes to Sound as Ever's Super Unreal Edition, Rusty writes a great little snippet around how UMI were kind of clearly the next big thing in the scene. Like, you could tell that they were like an amazing live band, had an amazing sort of singer and guitarist, and they were just, you know, an explosive force live, and clearly had songwriting chops. So I think there was something there. I think I've read that Tim, or someone associated with Tim, sort of just wrote a letter to Lee Rinaldo and sort of asked if he'd, you know, what does he think, and, you know, would you consider sort of, you know, working together or something like that, something along those lines. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was as simple as that I think UMI got some kind of local label deal, and through that they got in touch with Lee Rinaldo, which is a huge get. But at the same time, I guess, a similar sensibility of, like, not necessarily like a mainstream producer, but, like, you know, looking for good guitar, interesting guitar music. So
yeah,
that's what I know.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, no, I think that all makes sense. And they obviously, it was kind of self-directed, it seems like. They knew that he was the guy they wanted, and they were able to get him.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
So cool. All right, let's transition into the track. So coprolalia. And you might be able to clarify this, but that was the title of an earlier EP. But I don't believe the coprolalia appears on that earlier EP. Am I correct?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure, to be honest. I don't have that EP, but yeah, it's what I can say about it is I didn't actually know what coprolalia meant. I just thought it was a fancy word that sort of Tim made up. I only realized it was kind of, it means like it's the screaming form of Tourette's. I only realized that like a few weeks ago.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, as someone who came into UMI at the number 4 record, this, I never really fully appreciated what an amazing start to their, you know, debut album this song is. It's just like a song of absolute authority, you know, and because I was working backwards from number 4, like I got to it 4th and I was like, oh yeah, this is a pretty good song. But as we were kind of preparing for this, I've listened to it a few times and it's just, it's actually, if it's possible, grown on me over the last few weeks. Yeah, what do you reckon about it?
Yeah, I think that one thing that always kind of puzzled me with this record, because I associated UMI with kind of the mod, like the Who and the Small Faces and kind of like the very direct, obvious references on Owly Daily and Hi-Fi Way and Number 4 Record of that kind of era of music. And so it always kind of puzzled me in respect to kind of their association with grunge a little bit, being like, was that something that was kind of an organic type of songs that the band would have written anyway? Or was it a sense of like Nirvana a huge, Pearl Jam a big, let's write a tune that kind of is in that ballpark to kind of get us at the door type of thing? But I feel like, you know, re-listening to this song in a more focused way for this podcast, it made me think that, yeah, it is kind of like I felt, because I read Detours, the Tim Rogers book recently, and he references the Aerosmith influence and how he likes the early Aerosmith albums. I think that I can definitely hear some type of Aerosmith influence with the vocals. I don't think Tim Sims sings anything like Steven Tyler, but just in terms of the phrasing and I guess the way they complement the guitar, I think that it kind of, and also Berlin Chair as well, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but it made me realize that this is definitely not something that they were kind of doing to fit a trend. They were kind of like their influences kind of spewed out and it sounded like this. And so I just and obviously the lyrical content, because I'd read Detours very recently, it seems to be kind of almost like a direct diary entry reference to Tim's issues when he was studying, right? And being socially isolated and feeling kind of awkward and just weird around other people during that era, and the lyrics seem to reflect that.
Yeah, and being put on, I think, you know, antipsychotic meds, which I think proved problematic. So I think that song, like you say, is a direct reference to that. And yeah, musically, I would also say that, I know I've read about Tim's time, I think in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, where they were sort of kicking around and having fun. And you know, Nirvana was an enormous influence on everyone. I think I remember him saying like they were trying to get into like a Nirvana show in Sydney in the early 90s, I guess. And I think it's for us in our generation, we're just after that period, it's hard to kind of comprehend what an enormous influence they were at that time. I kind of have a bit of a sense. I was like, I don't know, 10 or 12. So I kind of, a lot of friends were sort of getting into it. I didn't quite grasp it, but you could kind of sense the groundswell. So undoubtedly that kind of scene would have influenced anyone who like guitar music, and so there's probably an element of that as well in that song and the record.
Apparently, according to someone online, the version with Tex Perkins is good. Yep. It's the bonus disc on Convicts. Is it? Yeah. Can you attest to that? Maybe that was the superfan. Could have been the superfan.
Well, listen, superfan. I thought, yeah, it's a good version. That was a bonus disc where UMI played a show with all guest vocalists, and yeah, Tex did an amazing screaming version of Coprolalia. I'd attest to that for sure.
Yeah, and I think it was just, it's definitely a very strong start to the record, and it was kind of I'd say this is a young man's kind of record, and you can tell like a young band made this album in a good way. Lots of energy, and yeah, this song initiated, and the other songs continued the feeling of kind of nostalgia for that era of where, which I think is lost now, where there was kind of like party albums and stuff that you'd play on at the background, and you'd maybe like get through it and then play it again. And I think that this is kind of like a very fitting opening to what was going to come next. So, all right, that's track one. Number two, the biggie, Berlin Chair. All right, let's try and say something interesting that hasn't been said prior. Yeah. How do we do that?
Well, I'll give it a go. Like, it's good actually that we're doing this podcast in this format, because we can get stuck into one of the big boys straight away. So it's worked out really nicely. Berlin Chair, how do I put it? Firstly, I'd say, as someone who came to UMI through Number Four record, the first version I really got into of it was from the Number Four record bonus disc, the Radio Sete live album, which is Live at the Wireless. And Tim does an acoustic version of Berlin Chair, which I think is just amazing. And so the first several years of my UMI fandom, that was the version that I loved the most. And it wasn't until, I don't know, a couple of years later, I eventually got it. I go, oh yes, I understand. Like, 'cause I knew Berlin Chair was the song that everyone loved and all that sort of stuff. But I always preferred the acoustic version. But then inevitably the main version just absolutely killed me. And it's just an amazing song. I think firstly, If You Wait, I'll Give All My Aches to You is just an amazing line. But I originally thought it was Eggs, I'll Give All My Eggs to You. And you know when you get a lyric wrong, but then you kind of try to justify, no, it would have been Eggs because, you put all your eggs in a basket, you can't put all your eggs in one basket, but maybe Tim did, and then he gave all his eggs from that basket to that person. So I got the lyrics wrong.
It's an Easter egg hunt gone wrong, gone terribly wrong. And I've got a little anecdote here I want to just add in from my online trawling. So the song Berlin Chair was featured in the Australian drama series Upright from 2019, written by Chris Taylor of The Chaser fame. During season one's episode 5, the appearance references a common misunderstanding of the lyrics to Berlin Chair. In the episode, a character listens to Berlin Chair while driving a car and repeatedly skips the song backwards as she tries to decipher a word in the song's chorus. The character initially thinks that the lyrics are, "If you wait, I'll give all my eggs to you," before later realizing that Rogers in fact sings, "I'll give all my eggs to you." So
right. There you go.
Yeah, it's a common Mondegreen where I don't know when I realized it was eggs or discovered it was eggs. It wasn't that long ago, but yeah, it's a common thing. And it's weird how it works both ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Perfectly.
And I remember in terms of my love of this song, I think it might have reached its peak, or, I realized the power of this song, the main version of it, when I was listening to Triple J. Just had this show, I don't know if they still got it, called the Oz Music Show. It was on every Thursday night. It was hosted by Richard Kingsmill. And one night they had, either a Best Australian Songs of All Time or a Best Australian Songs of the 90s kind of show. And it was 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. And I listened all the way on my little sort of transistor radio as soft can be. So not, I wouldn't wake up anyone in the house. And Berlin chair was number one. And I was just so excited. And I realized that little version, it was so soft in my ear, but it kind of like, it kind of entered my brain, even at that volume. And I remember being so excited, and that morning, the next morning I went to school and I was super tired. I barely slept that night because I was so excited. And I was telling my friends, and because our generation were kind of a few years beyond UMI's, I guess, popular peak, no one gave a shit. And I was like really upset. And that was kind of like a common trend for the next kind of like, 10 years where I'm trying to get people into UMI, but that was just basically no thanks, but no thanks. Or, a token effort here, I'll come to a show there. But that was the first time where I realized that I couldn't quite get other people on board.
Yeah, that was another kind of anecdote that I discovered, that it was Double J reviewer Dan Condon named the song the best Australian song in the 90s. This is going to be something interesting that'll come up. I'm not really a lyrics guy. I've always loved music, and I guess I'm probably more of a melody tone cat. And so, but I like the lyrics that will stand out and punch you in the face, the ones that you'll actually remember. And so you mentioned that I'll give all my eggs to you one, but I feel like I'm the rerun that you'll always force yourself to sit through is one of the best lyrics of all time. Like that's undeniable. And maybe it's kind of a generational thing, kind of the era that you grow up in. But I think that is kind of undeniable. But re-listening to this tune for this podcast, a few things jumped out. Firstly, the Lee Ranaldo production, the end. I didn't realize how much the end, the kind of dun 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 dun, 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 how much that sounds like Sonic Youth. The great kind of like the boppiness or the kind of like the vibrancy of the guitar is great. And another thing was just in terms of the general tone and kind of it's a power pop song, but there's an air of melancholy that runs through it. And my kind of just general takeaway, without overthinking it, listening to it when I'm drunk or fucked up or on the radio when I'm stone cold, it was always just like the general takeaway was like, oh, this guy's singing about a relationship where we're fucked, where it was kind of like we don't have much going on, but like really going through the lyrics, it's more a case of like I'm fucked. And that was something that where I was like, oh, that's it took on an extra level of sadness for me, and actually made me think about kind of the, if you think that a songwriter needs to kind of tap into any of the original emotion that they were feeling when they wrote the tune, and then if one of those where it's kind of like a sad one becomes a big hit, and then people like Berlin Chair, people from Perth, he gives shit from people from Perth in Detours, playing Berlin Chair. If that's the one, so you kind of have to revisit this kind of like shaky, a relationship being on shaky grounds because of your own ineptitude for the rest of your life. It was kind of like, it was dark. Just a perfect power pop song, and heartbreaking and uplifting at the same time, with some gems of takeaway lyrics that you can listen to again and again and again.
Yeah. And I would say, like, on the melancholy of the song, that really comes through in the acoustic version. So if anyone hasn't heard that, try get that sort of bonus disc from the number four record. And on lyrics, Some lyrics are pretty plain, but just work like in a song. And I think there's a couple in this song that are just perfect. Like the "if you wait," just those three words, the way that kind of, I don't know, that kind of meshes with the change in chords at that point is just perfection. And then of course at the end, you know, Tim's questioning, "Are you too late? Too late?" And the big scream, "Too late," into the sort of urgent, sound as ever. Sonic Youth.
Yeah.
ending is just like rock and roll perfection. I don't know how it gets better than that. That just so yeah, sometimes some plain lyrics just work so beautifully when the, you know, when the music's right. It's just a, it's just such a wonderful song.
All right, the first biggie in the bag. We did it. Bill and Cher. We did it. All right, so track three, Trainspotting. So I'll kick this one off. And sure. I'm not sure if you're aware about you're aware of this, Jono, but I occasionally like to play a game called How Can I Ruin Music from a Band I Like comparing it to an overplayed radio hit.
Oh yeah.
And in this particular installment, I'd like to say that the intro to Trainspotting reminds me a little of Footloose by Kenny Loggins. Can you hear
it? Right. Yeah.
It's maybe only 5 seconds.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. You have ruined it.
Once you hear Sorry, mate. Sorry. No, I'll make sure that it's only one track. I'll play this game one track for each record, but yeah, no, that's something that kind of jumped out at me where, again, listened to this tune in the past and hadn't focused on it. But yeah, the kind of the detailed listen, I would never consider myself a music reviewer by any way, shape or form, but I definitely do like the Wikipedia kind of network of trying to attach like, oh, what does this sound like? Or like, what is this reference by? And I'm definitely getting a little bit of Loggins, which, you know, nothing wrong with that. He's a hero. And, so anyway, now that I've got that out of the way, how are you feeling about this track?
Yeah, look, it's a good track. I don't have much to say about it, I guess. It's a track, I guess, through my listening of Sound As Ever that I'd listen to most of the time rather than all the time. So I'm thinking of a couple of versions that I like of this song. So there used to be this TV show on ABC TV on a late Thursday night called Studio 22, where you and I appeared on that particular show during, I think, their Dress Me Slowly promo tour. And they played a great kind of acoustic-y version with a guest fiddler on, violin guy. On that, so that was a really good version that's worth checking out. On the UMI reissue, the Super Unreal edition that came out in 2013 when they brought out, you know, they reissued three albums, Sound As Ever, Hi-Fi Away and Ali Daily. On the bonus disc of that, there's a great kind of acoustic-y track that was previously unreleased, the acoustic version of Trainspotting as well. So, yeah, good song, good solid tune, and it kind of continues the kind of energy of the album. So it's a good sort of accompaniment to the first couple of songs.
For me, it sounds like the we're all in our 20s and we're all changing at once type of vibe with a bunch of friends, and which I can definitely, I'm not in that phase of my life now, but I can definitely recall what that was like. It was kind of like, It could be the outro song for that The Secret Life of Us show.
That's right. the reference to splitting the bill and stuff like that is very, it takes you back. It's like you've got a bill of like $23 and there's eight of you and you got to like split the bill and all that sort of thing.
Totally. And and the kind of the talking about Exile on Main Street, and there's a lyric where he says, with a chord call or any Leon tape you'd push. And I'm guessing that's Leon Russell.
Could be, yeah. Never sort of dug into that.
Well, Leon Russell. Because he collaborated with the Stones and kind of like being a massive Stones guy. Yeah, so I was like,
of course.
My assumption would be Leon, the Leon tape that someone's pushing is. And the other kind of interesting thing that occurred to me, it was like, happy accident that this song gets released at the same year the book Trainspotting gets released.
Oh, right. Did not know that.
Yeah, well, Trainspotting, that is to do with heroin use, the tracks on your arm, and it doesn't seem like there's any, I guess, what is kind of why is this song called Trainspotting? Have you ever analyze that? Is it a case of like just watching your life change before you, or is that the kind of concept?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've never really thought about it, though. It's interesting to think of, yeah, because I mean, the etymology of train spotting, what is that? I know people refer to train spotters as kind of people who kind of look at like the randomness in various things, like in rugby league. It was just like my other sort of passion at the moment.
Plug, mate. I see how you slipped that.
No, they reference train spotters as people who like love the kind of random elements of rugby league history, like, you know, when Melbourne played Adelaide in Hobart in a preseason, you know, like some kind of randomness. That's how that's referred to. And okay. But I know obviously train spotting, the movie became big and it was kind of related to drugs, but I don't actually know why it's called train spotting or actually what train spotting means. I've never looked at the definition.
Yeah. Just as a random anecdote, Noel Gallagher, songwriter from Oasis, and later kind of touring buddies with UMI, he got approached for Oasis music to be in the movie Trainspotting, and he turned it down because he's like, I don't want my fucking music in a movie about fucking trains. so I feel good. Like, yeah, the reference went over his head at the time as well. So,
there is just a definition I've just quickly looked up. Train spotting is the practice of watching trains, particularly as a hobby, with the aim of noting distinctive characteristics. So I think
that was my understanding as well. Yeah, it was kind of like akin to bird watching a little bit. Yeah. Yeah, but anyway. Yeah, good on you, Timmy. You've got us thinking. You've got us Googling in 2022. You fucking genius. All right, so track 4, Adam's Ribs. Jono, take us away.
Well, this song actually reminds me of you, Tommy.
I remember this moment. I was going to tell the anecdote as well, the Montreal house party.
Exactly. So Tom and Tom's lovely partner took me in when they were living in New York, and you guys looked after me for a good week or so, at least a week. Jeez, I think I overstayed my welcome there. And you took me on a Greyhound bus trip from New York to Montreal. And, you know, that's an experience in itself. But we got to Montreal, beautiful city, and it was a beautiful – it must have been, I guess, fall, I guess, was it?
Yeah, it was perhaps this time of year maybe. It was the summer, yeah.
So, like, the trees – I remember the trees, you know, turning their shades of leaves. It was just golden. And we went to this house party with a few people you knew, and I didn't know anyone – but you knew people that I was feeling, you know, as I do, I just feel super awkward in any situation, but you were trying to make me feel comfortable, and you took over kind of DJing duties, or you took over the laptop that was playing the tunes, and you said, no, I want to play this song, this Aussie song, my mate here from Sydney, we're going to play this song, what should we play? And I'm like, oh, and then you said, what UMI song should we play? And obviously, like, I was like, oh God, which one? And I was overthinking it. And you know what, Adam's Ribs. I'm going to play Adam's Ribs. And I'm like, I'm not sure this is the right one. Is that the right one I want to get people?
But you put it on. Shut up, Jono. I'm going to do it. Yeah.
And you put it on, and it was, you know, it sounded great to me. I don't think it won anyone over, you know, at that particular party. But you know, it was a great, moment, and it's a good tune. And
I was going to tell this exact same anecdote in that. I've maybe because I've heard the varied stories of you putting your foot in it and maybe, you know, trying to kind of push the UMI drug onto people who weren't ready for it. Yeah. There are certain tunes in certain situations which work. And I feel like where it's going to be like, you know, I can't really relate to people with music and even people who are my age. I feel like everyone's become pretty much siloed off unless you're a fan of kind of generic Spotify playlist pop stuff. You're kind of going to be segregated, and the algorithm rewards your own kind of peculiarities and addictions. Mm-hmm. So you can't really expect people to get what you like. So really when you say people, you're like, I'm not sure if people were digging it, But yeah. No one was like, turn this shit off.
That's true. That's a win.
So it kind of fit. That was from memory, a jangly end of the weekend. I've had 120 beers over 72 hours. And I pretty much everyone at that party was in a similar vibe. And at the time, it worked. And I think it kind of did. I didn't overplay my hand. It was just the one tune that I dropped in that particular, but I think it worked in that particular situation. Made Jono happy. And it's definitely, I think, very much the standout obvious choice for go back to 1993. This is going to be the first single off the record. Do you agree?
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I think, like, in hindsight, the band have often spoken about, you know, I can't believe we didn't kick off with Berlin Chair as the first single. But yeah, when you think about the context of the time, it makes a lot of sense. And the way it kind of like it rolls throughout those 3 minutes of the song and then just tunes up towards the end, it's pretty exciting. And it would have been a cracking live track. And there are a couple of really cracking live versions on the various bonus discs.
Well, yeah, and I think that to kind of round things off, I'd always just interpreted this song as kind of like the epitome of kind of like a 90s song. And I think, honestly, that's to do with the music video where Tim and the band are looking extremely 90s. About it is like the
epitome. Right,
And it's a cool video from memory. I think it's when they're on tour in the States in Vegas or somewhere. But so that kind of like clouded my judgment. But I listened to it again, and it honestly reminds me so much of The Who, like the early Who. Right. There's this cool clip of The Who playing I Can't Explain, which I believe was their first single. And it's like early days of The Who where like Roger Daltrey's wearing like sunglasses on stage. And that's when all their kind of mod fans were just like hopped up on amphetamines. And there's a really cool kind of like music video and kind of that energy of the track, I feel like is replicated somewhat in the kind of ongoing repetitive beat. And that's something that this band I like called the OCs. It's kind of like a one man project. John Dwyer, he talks about like where every couple tracks on his records, he asks, I believe he has drummers. He has not just one drummer, plural. He says this one needs a bonehead beat where it's just that boom chat, boom boom chat. And so this is the epitome of kind of like, we want the bonehead beat. We want the kind of like ongoing repetitive three chord riff, but it's perfect and there's kind of like freedom within that. And so it reminded me of The Who, but through very much a 90s filter. And I think that's why I like it so much.
Well, incidentally as well, on the Berlin Chair single Can't Explain, is a B-side on that single. There you go.
There you go. Just to round things off properly, I always think of Daniel Johns because this song is obviously about anorexia. And I'm not sure if you're aware, he just dropped a very recent video a couple of days ago where it was like a self-produced thing on YouTube.
I read a headline.
He basically just opened up about why he got arrested for drink driving. It was like 9 months ago. And just talking about all the shit. It was pretty raw, but it was one of those kind of like self-produced things where he's like, it's time to open up. And it's like, I smell a new record.
Because there's been like a Daniel Johns podcast recently, the life of Daniel
mini
Johns.
Mini documentary series. So yeah, there's something cooking commercially. But anyway, it just made me think about Silverchair, the name taken from Sliver, the Nirvana song, and Berlin Chair. And I was like, I wonder, teenage Daniel Johns, throes of his anorexia, listening to this particular song, like, this would have been his fucking anthem. Like, this song is all about, you know, just if we don't eat, everything will be fine.
That's right.
It's just a very, like, when you know for a fact someone was a huge fan of a record and then thinking they must have listened to this at a particular stage in their life. This must have been a very impactful song for Mr. John. So,
yeah, that's true. That's true. I wonder if that'll come out in the subsequent Soft Focus videos before the new album.
Definitely. We can only hope. All right, track five, Rosedale. Jono.
Rosedale.
Immediate thoughts?
Yeah, well, one of my favorite songs, actually, of the album. I just love the kind of descending riff that kind of kicks off the song. I didn't actually realize that – this is embarrassing as a New South Wales person, but I didn't realize Rosedale was a place in New South Wales, and only realized it was a place. I just thought it was kind of a random word or maybe the name of a pub or something. But there's a reference to Rosedale in The Waterboy, which is the single off Yuma's latest album, The Lives of Others. And I'm like, oh, hang on, Rosedale might be a place. I looked it up. It's on the south coast of New South Wales, around kind of Ulladulla and all that sort of stuff. So anyway, but back to the song. It's a beautiful song. I don't really know what it's about, but it kind of sounds like, you know, 20-somethings just about to sort of take on the world, basically.
Yeah.
And you know, at the end of the song, it's kind of see you around the world, which is kind of a beautiful way to finish the song. One of the features of the song, which I love, which I'd love to see more in rock and roll, is like dialogue in song. So in this particular song, there's, you know, dialogue where, you know, I think it might be Rusty comes in and says, is it cool if I grab a little
grab
of your time?
Grab a little of your time. That was my question. I was like, is that Rusty or Mark? And Is it Andy or Mark? Yeah.
No idea. Good point. It wasn't Rusty.
Because Mark sings the second last track,
that's
right?
That's right, off the field, yeah. So yeah. I've got no idea. I'm going to say, for argument's sake, Mark, I've got no idea why. But, yeah, dialogue in songs, I think it's a beautiful kind of exchange. And then, like, at the end, kind of Tim screaming back, and it's fantastic. I'd love to hear more of it. What do you think of Rosedale?
All the points you essentially just kind of took out of my mouth. See you around the world. And I feel like, I don't know, that this is one where, as I referenced before, kind of the concept of like the party record, like you'd have it on at a party. Because for some reason, I think that the next You and My albums, I don't know if this is just kind of my own perspective clouding things, but I feel like they're more personal and deep, and they've got the big hit singles, and then maybe kind of like the party kind of dancey tracks. But there's something about this one where it feels kind of like built for the kind of like, yeah, we're having a few people round on a Friday night or a Saturday night. Yeah. You can have it on in the background without anyone's buzz getting killed, and it kind of elevating the mood. And I feel like this is the epitome of that type of vibe. Whereas the other records, I feel like the songs are almost too good or too personal, where people kind of like get tangent off into their own kind of space. Yeah. So for me, this one, it just reminded me kind of the era. And I was curious about Rosedale as well, but you answered that question for me. So
I could see that this album would be a good party album. Like you say, I think it'd go well. And then there's the odd sort of moment, or plenty of moments in the album, where people go, "Ooh, this is good. What's this?" Or, "Ooh, I like this bit," that kind of thing. On whether it's the UMI party album, I've thought about this as someone who's never thrown a party, but someone who's never really thrown a party, but thought about it. You know, maybe one day I will. Which UMI album would I put on? I'm naturally inclined, before talking to you now, to go Hi-Fi Way or Number 4 Record, or even Convicts. You know, direct. I do understand where you're coming from. There's personal moments as well, but Hi-Fi Way for me is that kind of like punchy and sparky kind of album that I probably would revert to first. But yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe this is the way to go. Sound as ever. That's why you throw the best parties, mate. You do it differently to the rest of us.
Yeah, that's going to be me. All right, it's time for Adam's Ribs once again in the fucking retirement village one day.
Repeat.
Yeah. All right, next track, Forever and Easy. So, again, this is for me where the Aerosmith kind of vibe with the guitar. I was like, again, this is another one where I wouldn't have known this if I hadn't read Detours, but he's Timmy's buddies with the guy from the Black Crowes. I think there's a small there's a small detour within that book where he's just finished a show in LA and there's no one there, and then the lead singer from the Black Crowes comes in and he's like, they can kind of share some solidarity about some rock star stuff, and he took some solace from that. But anyway, it just kind of reminded me of American kind of bluesy rock, Aerosmith, Black Crowes, but then also kind of like I sensed kind of like some Manchester, Stone Roses, kind of Fool's Gold type of that riff as well. Maybe some John Squire riffage as well, which, again, it had just been something for me where I'd listened to this record in the past. I hadn't processed kind of what are the influences here and all that, but I definitely felt like I could see myself as a 17-year-old when this came out. This would kind of be like me and my buddies, our Dazed and Confused, cruising in the Holden Commodore. let's turn this up. There's some cheeky babes up ahead. Let's turn on Forever and Easy. I kind of like the whole kind of vibe of this, and it made me nostalgic for the era once again.
Yeah, and this is like the ultimate in riffage. This is the kind of track, you know, the first riff, the kind of, I guess, chorus riff, whatever you call it. For me, this might have been the song at the top of the show. I talked about the anecdote where I got caught by my father rocking out. This might have been the song that I was caught out. I know it was during the Dress Me Slowly era, but it might have been this song because it's that kind of song that makes you want to play incredible rock guitar. It's also got great screams in it and like great sort of harmonies at the end about, you know, taking it easy or whatever the word is at the end. Because I came into UMI in 98 and only saw them live, I think, from 2000, I don't think I ever saw it live, and I always wanted to see it live, but I did see it live once, I think, from memory, at a Sunday afternoon gig at the Annandale Hotel. It might have been, 2006, 2007 or something. I can't quite remember. But it was a Saturday afternoon. It was like 40 degrees in Sydney. I don't know why they played a Saturday afternoon gig, but they did. But I love the idea of Sunday afternoon rock. It was it worked beautifully. It was boiling, and they played, I think they just come from Shark Park in Cronulla. They played like a festival there. They played a set there and then came to the Annandale to play a Sunday afternoon set. It was a bit looser than usual, and they played a few different songs, including, I think, Forever and Easy. And I was like, yes, finally. And it was a really good rendition too.
There was that era, I think maybe like 10 years ago, where Rogers was going around saying, do I need to replace myself as the singer of You Are Mine, just be the guitarist? And that was something where I was always just like, what are you talking about, man? Like singer-songwriter, you know, best song of the 90s and all that, like just acclaimed, you can sing and you can write songs, and that's what you should continue doing. But you can't, and I guess, again, reading the book and kind of like learning about his experiences in, was it Box the Jesuit?
That's right.
Other band, and just kind of like getting some appreciation for how good a guitarist he was, and just kind of how much like of a, I think Dave Grohl is the undisputed rock pig in the world. Like if it was just someone who wants to fucking, roll around in the shit of rock for the rest of their life, it would be Davey G. But Timmy's up there. He's a man who just, he loves, riffage, and he's an artist as well. We can't forget that, but it's tracks like this that make me kind of, and also kind of the whole himself doubting his ability to sing well and give his do his songs justice and that whole kind of insecurity trip. But it's songs like this that make me realize that, like, oh, he does, there's a part of him that would just be happy to be Pete Townsend, be the guitar god, and focus and exist in that realm, and kind of the whole songwriting stuff is just kind of like almost an added bonus in some respects.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And reading Detours as well, it gives you a good insight into, I guess, the different sides of him. Yeah, there's definitely a side who would love to kind of just be the guitarist in a rock and roll band. I mean, he's just joined his favorite band, kind of the Hard-Ons, so that there's an element there. But there's also the side of him that, you know, just wants to have a cup of tea and kind of read poetry or listen to kind of Greek music or whatever it is. So, but yeah, I think this shows that he's got the chops. He had the chops. He'll always have the chops if he wants to sort of access this side of it and the rockery and the riffage. So, yeah, great tune.
Track 7, Everyone's to Blame.
Everyone's to Blame, yeah.
That definitely something that I'm pretty sure I wrote a poem with that title, maybe Year 9 poetry or something. Nice. That type of feeling where you kind of like, yeah, let's all accept a responsibility here, folks. And and something else that jumped out at me was I believe there is a rhyme that he pretty much he says, if I could rip at your shirt just to see it if it'll hurt. I believe old mate Timmy recycles this rhyme years later in Kick a Hole in the Sky, crawling through the dirt to see where it hurts. And I recall that because, like, it was Kick a Hole in the Sky was on our, me and my buddy Alex's, kind of when we'd play FIFA with each other. That was like the standard.
Oh, right.
So we'd always chime in with each other no matter how aggressive we were being with each other on the virtual pitch. We'd always harmonize with one another for that particular lyric. And I was like, oh, he's kind of like, it's a similar type of thing, but I, you know, it's kind of like the, if you're influenced by country and Western music, rip it your shirt just to see if it'll hurt. That's
beautiful.
That's something that you'll need to use many times in your career. But what are your thoughts on this particular tune?
Yeah, it's one of the favorite songs, one of my favorite songs on the album. I think it's an unsung hero of the album. That's how I describe it. And I think everything about the song is kind of underrated in a way. Like, I've never heard anyone kind of say Everyone's to Blame is one of your mind's best, and maybe it's not, but I just think it's a high quality track. And interesting where you say Everyone's to Blame, like it's kind of like, let's all share the blame. I've always taken it as everyone but me is to blame. I've always thought the character in this song is like kind of blaming everyone else, and everyone's to blame except me. But I don't actually know if the song's about much at all. But I just love how after like the sort of intense and sort of rolling start to the album, we get to this point and the vocal is a bit more measured, and it's quite melodic. And it's really a bit more of a slow burn of a song. And I think it's actually a perfect way to kind of to progress the album from that really intense and kind of full on first 6 tracks. And it, even like the last kind of minute of the song where you know, gets that kind of lead guitar. I love that, how that kind of plays out. I reckon it's one of my favorite sort of guitar bits. It's nothing, you know, out there, but I think it's absolutely perfect for the tune.
I
don't think I've seen it live either, unfortunately.
Oh, interesting. That's why they're just not playing it, so you keep coming to shows.
Exactly.
They're like, yeah, maybe this time. Yeah, well, let's address kind of the Timmy's vocals or his singing.
Sure.
And because he references in Detours that he started singing because essentially the other guys like couldn't sing whatsoever. So he'd never really had confidence. There's that anecdote in the book where he kind of, you know, having a few drinks or maybe sharing a jazz cigarette with his uni buddies. And then he rips out Pinball Wizard on the acoustic guitar and, you know, really good guitarist. Everyone's impressed. And one of his mates like, come on, Timo, that was fucking all right, but you can't sing for shit, mate. Oh, and, yeah, so like cut him deep or like made him extra insecure. But a couple of things, he can sing. The it's different where someone's kind of like out of tune and it's abrasive on your ear. So like he's in tune, and also you can if you have a really good singer, it's going to screw up the longevity of your band. Like, because they're inevitably going to lose their voice. Whereas if someone is always has a kind of like unique or kind of non-standard singing voice, that is always going to be okay because that's the expectation. And I feel like, yeah, I like his voice. I think it suits his songs. I think he uses it well. There's parts on this album where he really like pushes it out where he clearly wouldn't do that anymore. In terms of he's not going to be able to hit those notes consistently or whatever. But I think that in terms of like the singers that he clear, like Paul Weller would be another one for me from the Jam. I'm like, yeah, it's not the best singer in the world, but for what he's going for, it works. And so I'd put Rogers in that category. And I think that you're not thinking about this, or I assume musicians aren't thinking about this when they first start writing, recording records, but it is going to help you in the long run because you can only get more character and more kind of the graveliness or whatever happens to your voice. You can kind of play with it and fuck around with it, as opposed to Freddie Mercury's of the world where it's like pristine, perfect voice. The only way is down from there. So I think it's actually a real asset. It's a real strength. It's an asset of the band for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know it straight away when you hear Tim, it's Tim's voice. So that's a huge strength. Yeah, it's maybe not the strongest voice ever, but it's produced some of the great vocal moments in Australian history. Like, he can reach those moments. And in these early albums, and even now when he's kind of screaming, rock and roll screaming is not easy to do. That's a real skill. I can't do it, as I mentioned before. Like, I can only do it in a whisper. Like, I can only mime it. It's a real skill. So, like, I guess it doesn't have the robustness of some vocalists, but it's his voice, and I think he's got a beautiful kind of turn of melody. When I started listening to UMI, and I was trying to explain to friends at school why I like them. And I don't have the musical kind of lexicon. I'd say they're just really good at verses. And I think what that meant in my mind was I loved the way he would use melody in the verses for whatever reason, like the way he would use his voice as an accompaniment or a juxtaposition to the guitars just for a simple melodic line. I think he's got an incredible skill on that level. And yeah, like I say, there's some of the great vocal moments of Australian music history that's come from his mouth. So when people say he can't sing, I just, you know, scoff basically and put my hand up and walk away.
Amen to that. All right, track 8, Jamie's Got a Gal. Bold move, writing songs about your family members.
It is.
And it's something where, you know, because this was a track that was on The Cream and the Croc, and so I've been listening to this song for the last 20 years. And yeah, I became aware over the years that it was about his brother leaving the band, essentially. And kind of like when you're young, you don't really understand the kind of gravity of that, perhaps. Not necessarily someone like moving on, deciding to leave a band, but like writing about it and publicly kind of putting your feel. Like, so I'm just curious, what was the kind of next family dinner like?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a very good question. Yeah, there's that line, game's a game. Sure ain't my place to say, but you sure ain't like you were yesterday. That is so brutal.
I know. It's kind of like, is the new missus a bitch? That's what if I'm picking up what he's putting down here, like, it's couched obviously because he's kind of like, the things I promised not to do with you today, I sure need to tonight. So someone feels like a bender, and Bruvs was usually there, to help out. And, it's, you know, and it also just must be weird to be a part of a band, you know, like family's kind of forever, whether you like it or not. So it would be just very interesting to know, like, what it was like for these guys to, the first time Jamie heard this song, and then like, what's both Tim and Jamie's relationship with this song now? Like, fuck, those were crazy days. I can't believe I wrote a song about you just opting out of a band. But anyway, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought the same thing, and I think that's natural, I guess. It's like when – has anyone ever said to you, you've changed, mate? That it just hurts so much. Like, what? No, I haven't changed. You've changed. Yeah. Well,
that's just, yeah.
I don't know the specifics of their relationship, probably like typical big bro, little bro stuff. But, yeah, in general, when you're related to a storyteller or a songwriter or something and you're consuming something like that, you know, is there any sense of like appreciating the art of it? Or would you just like be going, what was that? You know, like,
is that about hanging on every word. I'm going to get my attorney on the line, mate. No. Yeah, yeah. No, it's, just putting myself in, maybe Jamie doesn't give a shit. And it's not like he goes in on anything that deep here, but it's just the explicit. He could have called it like Jerome's Got a Gal or something. He could have, changed the name perhaps. Just the way that he counts it in at the beginning is just like completely, normal, even tone. But then it goes into kind of like a pretty deep and an admission of sorts. Yeah. But,
how does the song start? Again? James Got a Girl. Don't think things gonna be the same. He ain't coming out drinking tonight. Think he's gonna change his name. Oh, that's just something. But what I would say is that there is a companion piece to this song, I believe, in Tim's solo record. I think his fourth solo record, The Luxury of Hysteria. The closing track of that is called James the Second, and it's it's one of my favorite all-time Tim songs. It's I feel like I'm going to say that so many times over the course of this series, but it really is.
Lots of jewels, mate, not many bullets.
Exactly. And this song is so beautiful. It's kind of like a mea culpa in a way, sort of saying we've been through a lot, but you know, I still love you, bro. And like the chorus is like, somewhere you know this damn thing's still just yours and mine, yours and mine. So in my mind, you know, it's about his brother, I know that, but in my mind, it's a nice way of tying this bow where it's kind of like, yes, we've had our issues, I guess. I don't know. They might be really close. I've got no idea. But from a musical sense, from an art sense of what he's put out, there's this song going, hey, you've left the band. You've left me in the lurch. I feel shit now because of it. But now this song sort of ties that bow and says, I still love you. This thing that I've built, it's actually ours. It always has been, always will be. So if anyone who hasn't heard that song, I encourage you to listen to it because it's absolutely beautiful. And it really is a cracking song just in and of itself. But there's also that level of, brotherhood as well.
That's why he's a super fan, folks. Not the super fan, but he's looking into the future. He's looking into solo records. He's tying loops that you didn't even know were there. That's why he's here. Johnny.
Yeah, that's right.
Johnny's bringing the heat. All right, track 9. Who's leaving you now?
Now, I guess, look, if you're being – I think what people would say about this album is maybe this is the point it starts losing a bit of steam. Which maybe sounds harsh. I haven't listened to Who's Leaving You Now too much over the years. I think it's a rare Andy Kent songwriting credit. Nothing else comes to mind that he's on. I'm happy to be corrected on that. But listening to it over the last couple of weeks preparing for this, appreciated a bit more. And I think it's actually a pretty good hangover song. I went out for a few beers the other night and was listening to it, feeling sorry for myself the next morning. And It hit me like right in the sweet spot. So yeah, decent tune, a bit of an album track, nothing wrong with it at all. What do you think?
For me, just the takeaway was the sounds like Radiohead, which I'd never thought about before.
Early Radiohead,
The early 90s Radiohead, similar era where I was like, oh yeah, there's Radiohead would probably the obviously very different kind of operatic vocals on top and then crescendo with kind of guitars would be a bit different. But, yeah, I just thought it was kind of like, yeah, it sounded I like the way that it's kind of sparse and position, you know, things are kind of in the right place. And yeah, I would say, yeah, definitely a cool calm down song for me. Yeah. And yeah, it definitely does signal kind of like the end is coming up. But but I think that it ends in an interesting way, this album, and which we'll kind of get to now. But Ordinary, track 10. This is another one that I believe was on the best, the Cream of the Croc. So I've been listening to this one for years. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, this was one of the songs that I came to first, that hit me first in my listening of Sound as Ever. Like I said before, this was the fourth album that I came to of UMI. And I guess, you know, I was in that kind of you know, sensitive part of my life where acoustic songs were hitting me. And so, Ordinary definitely hit me. I think it's a great tune. Actually, this kind of brings up some embarrassing stuff as well. I used to, after sort of getting into UMI and stuff, I picked up a guitar and sort of taught myself how to play guitar with my brother's guitar and a chord book. And this was one of the first songs that I was able to play. Because I used to go on, there used to be, there's a website, umi.com.au, which is different to the one now. And it was kind of like a fan site. I think Davey Lane actually helped run
it. He learned everything, right? That's how they found him. Is that that's right, folklore I've always understood, but that was the truth of the matter?
Yeah, because you used to go on and go to the tabs section of the website, and it would have like all these songs transcribed. And Davey Lane would be one of the names. I think the other guy was Danny Yayu, I think. And yeah, so Davey probably transcribed Ordinary for me. Thank you. And it was one of the few, because like I don't know anything about music. I just had this chord book and this guitar. It was easy for me to understand, because I think it's like D minor, G, C, B minor, A minor. So I knew the shapes of that, whereas the other, you know, a lot of other chords I just didn't understand, and I didn't know how to do bar chords or anything like that. So anyway, I kind of learned how to do a really bad version of it. And during like end of high school, early uni, I would, there'd inevitably be a guitar around, and I'd sort of grab it and try to play Ordinary. And like, I honestly wasn't very good. And it wasn't long before someone took the guitar off me. And then, because like everyone wants to sing along to songs. And like I said, I was a couple of years younger than most, the UMI sort of generation, I guess. So people at these parties were never heard it, just not interested. People want to sing along to, I don't know, Foo Fighters or whatever, you know. So the guitar was always pretty swiftly taken off me, but I'd always try.
Yeah, no, I feel like for me, this track is kind of perhaps the most kind of direct precursor of the more introspective acoustic songs that we'd get on Hi-Fi Way. Or Hourly Daily, kind of the Tim solo part of the repertoire, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, it definitely holds up. There is one particular lyric I'm curious whether you can enlighten me what the fuck it means. Everyone who's watching now at the movie that's always rerun can throw a laugh and stick in the pinks. What the fuck does stick in the pinks mean?
I've got no idea. Can I be brutally honest with you? I didn't know it was stick in the pinks. I thought it was stick in the pan. So there you go.
Another eggs and eggs situation.
Yeah, stick in the pinks. Is that kind of sexual? Like, I'm very naive when it comes to this stuff. Like,
I don't think he'd throw out a stick in the pinks.
That's good. I'm so naive with this stuff. Like that stuff always goes over my head. So I'm always assuming I'm missing something. But
And it's also like, I don't know, but I just had no. The super fan. If you're out there, get in touch. Anyway, what I kind of also like about this, and it's perhaps because I was fortunate enough to have a bunch of my mates, into UMI. At once, and so like maybe in kind of like when we were like 18, 19, like one guy would have a girlfriend, and then there'd be one of those situations where it'd be like 10 guys and like one or two girls, and then the guys with girlfriends would go home, and there'd just be like eight dudes like let's drink some more beer and smoke some more weed, and we'd like play some albums, and it would be like, I don't know, playing some Mario Kart or whatever. And then you get to like a quiet introspective track, and then everyone would just kind of feel lonely and like, why don't I have a girlfriend? So that's we didn't actually do that with this album, but we did it with plenty of other albums, and it was always around track 8, 9 where they drop one of these, we'd be like, even though you may have just won on Mario Kart 64 battle, the victory wasn't quite that sweet, because you're maybe thinking about your lot in life a little too deeply. So anyway,
brought back feeling all too well
some funny memories. So anyway, that's Ordinary, track 11, You Scare Me. And I just felt like this is kind of like the you and my laying claim to being a part of the Australian kind of like bastion of pub rock. I was like, this is just Tunnel Vision rock and roll, baby. This is like, I don't know. It's something that I'd never really thought of before. I was like, it doesn't sound that dissimilar from like the Screaming Jets or something.
Right.
Where I'd never really, I'd always thought that like, even though kind of You and My's a dirty rock and roll band, I'd always thought they were kind of slightly more highbrow, kind of like than the Stand, you know, those kind of like meat and potatoes Aussie rock bands. But I was like, oh, this song kind of fits into that mold. Right. Am I off track here? Do you kind of see what I'm getting at?
When you say it, I can gather, I guess. For me, it's one of the songs I haven't really got into as much as the other ones, but obviously the last couple of weeks I have. It's a slow burner, so it's an unusual track for You and My. Probably could be one of their longest tracks, if not their longest track. And for any long track, you know, there's got to be payoff for your effort, you know, return on investment. And I think this one, sorry for the financial lingo, how embarrassing, but like this one does give you that payoff with a cracking sort of chorus and there's keys at the end. It sort of becomes like pretty weird at the end, which I never really noticed until like listening to it properly. So I'm going to sort of say I'm with you half the way there, but I'm not going to go all the way with you on that observation. But in terms of what we were saying earlier about just simple lyrics that just work in a song sometimes, just the phrase "You Scare Me," I think is like a beautiful terrain for rock music, and is probably untapped generally. And I think it's an interesting one, and probably relates to the kind of the subject matter perhaps of the first song around coprolalia and sort of meds and stuff like that, maybe. But I'm not 100% sure, but it's interesting terrain.
Yeah, and to be clear, I found it endearing, where I could feel like there were similarities or connections to other kind of staples of Australian rock, whereas I just assumed that kind of You and My and Roger's stuff was always kind of like, maybe because of his voice or the quirks of his songwriting, it always kind of like stood off slightly to the side, not as an elitist thing, but more just kind of like it's very unique. And this, where I was like, oh, I see where I can kind of almost like smell the pubs in the late 80s or something. Like there was something kind of like tactile about it, where I was like, oh, this is kind of the Aussie pub rock that was popular in the 80s and they were clearly like born out of. With obviously Roger's kind of specific songwriting skills on top of that.
Yeah, I see you.
Track 12, Off the Field. Just with this one, this was one where it was like, you know, when it's kind of you're trying to understand what was the actual, like, was this only in Australia, this track, or
I think it was left off the subsequent American release. So it was interesting and obviously, you know, appropriate that it was part of the reissue that came out in 2013. So yeah, but for me, this was the fourth album I got into of You and My, I knew that there were movements from the drummer in terms of the drummer's seat at the end of this album, and that this song didn't make subsequent additions. For me, it was like, oh, it's not really a You and My song, so I'm not gonna spend much time on it. So I haven't I think I only listened to it all the way through for the first time a couple of weeks ago, because I've always kind of like, well, this is not part of the album, so I'm just going to skip from 11 to 13 straight into Sound as Ever. But listening to it over the last couple of weeks, it's not a bad tune. It's a good riff. It sort of goes in, you know, it kind of rocks a bit. But yeah, I mean, I haven't really spent too much time with it. I felt like the couple of listens that I've had over the last couple of weeks, you know, I was kind of like, well, when does Sound as Ever start? But to be fair, it's that's only because I haven't really given it as much a chance as I should have.
Yeah, no, I would tend to agree with all that. And, you know, I think it's interesting after the kind of introspective 8-19-year-old boys playing Mario Kart, why are we all single vibes of Ordinary, then they've kind of got the tunnel rock of You Scare Me off the field and Sound as Ever, which kind of like gets you going again. And so I feel like they've, just in terms of the flow of the album, it's a kind of I just think it kind of fits well in between You
point.
Scare Me and Sound as Ever, where it was kind of like let's end this on kind of like a similar vibe. So and I just felt like the riff itself was kind of like Velvet Revolver esque, where it was kind of like a very low, kind of like a lo-fi version of what like Velvet Revolver would do.
Yeah.
Not that I was a huge fan of them, but I was like, oh, it's kind of like similar, again, maybe like an Aerosmith type of thing, just a big kind of like cock rock type of tune, which I think if you're a young man, that's kind of what you want.
Yeah, it's kind of like, okay, we've got a song, we need a riff, and what about this? It's a good riff, and it kind of, so lucky Tim has an unlimited grab bag of riffery.
Hell yeah. All right, closing track, Titular, is that how you say that? Track 13, yeah. Sound Titular? As Ever. Titular.
I don't know.
Oh, Dave, you buy me a drink first. So what are your thoughts?
Oh, look, it's just a perfect way to end this album. It's become a live staple, I've noticed, the last, I don't know, 10 years. It's always now kind of like towards the end of the show or in an encore. And actually, there's an incredible live version from the Someone Else's Crowd bonus live disc, I think from Seattle. I think that was when they supported Soundgarden, that kind of tour there, which just shows Timmy at his absolute best, incredible vocal performance and riffery at the same time. It's just an incredible performance. But in terms of the album track, you know, the whole, it's the same theme as Coprolalia and Maybe You Scare Me around, you know, I can read your degree now, give me my medicine about being prescribed an inappropriate level or amount of meds, I think, and, you know, Sound, I guess, saving him. And so it's good on that level, and from a musical sense as well. It's a great riff and a great sort of climax. And the, I guess, Ronaldo, I don't know if this is a Ronaldo thing, but the mashup at the end with the little snippets from the various songs, which was a nice touch.
Yeah, no, and that jumped out at me as well, because I feel like there are, as a young man, I was a real Beatles head guy, and that was maybe something which I was like, oh, You and My Tim Rogers is always kind of like more on the Stones side of the fence. And I was like, but there are those kind of like snippets at the end. It's kind of almost White Album-esque, where the Beatles would like, you know, I think it's in, All You Need Is Love, where they're someone saying, she loves you, yeah. And so in this, there's a similar thing where he's singing the tracks from the other albums. And so I was like, oh, that's interesting. It's kind of like you and my song with something kind of Beatles-esque, like the song Tuesday is one where it's like, oh, that's kind of like Day in the Life or something. There's not very kind of many Beatles-esque moments, but I'd find the end of this one. And yeah, it's just a cracking crescendo. And first of all, it's a cool title. Like, it's a great album title, Sound as Ever. It's kind of like, growing up, my old man used to make said that Scousers always used to say, "Sound as a pound lying on the ground, waiting to be found." So it's like, if you have a sound, you are cool.
Yeah,
but
right.
It's kind of got like this. So sound as ever, like I'm fine as ever. Mm. But yeah, with this lyric, and as you were kind of referencing before, it's kind of like, yeah, just the fact that he's alone with sound, and that's his say, you know, his savior, his kind of like purpose. And yeah, it's a great way to close this record.
Yeah. And it's mentioned in his book as well, isn't it? So it's absolutely like still a big part of his life. And it's kind of had ongoing impacts of that kind of period. So yeah, it kind of has a bit more gravity to that. Just incidentally, I think, I don't know if I'm imagining this, but I think it's coming back to me now that the title of the album perhaps was going to be called Sound as Never originally, and then they thought better. So I'm not sure if I'm making that up, but I'm pretty sure that was the case, or it has been mentioned somewhere. But it was Sound as Ever in the end.
All right, so they're the tracks.
What an album! What a record!
What a record! What a start! So yeah, just in terms of kind of any final thoughts here in respect to. Yeah, why don't we do that? We'll talk, like, why don't you read the kind of the rusty note that you mentioned to me? Because Mark Tunnelay, is that how you say it? He was the drummer on this record.
Yeah.
He left after the record came out, and then Rusty came in, which kind of changed the band dynamics. We'll talk about that in the next step. But read me Rusty's note about him coming in.
Yeah, so this is on the reissue that came out in 2013, super unreal edition of Sound as Ever. And these are the great things. It's what you don't really get, in the digital era, the sort of tactile booklets and the stories that come through in this. And so in each of these reissues, Sound as Ever, Hi-Fi Away, and Ali Daily, there's a little story that's written. In this case, it's by Rusty. I think in Hi-Fi Away, it might be by Lee Ronaldo, interestingly, so I might dig that up. But in this case, Rusty addresses, I guess, not the elephant in the room, but like the issue that sort of has been spoken about on message boards and things over the years. How did it come about that Mark Tunnelay left and Rusty came into the band? And I think, Rusty in this particular booklet, does it really well, does it really sensitively and appropriately. So I'll just read out the snippet and we can sort of chat about it. But essentially, Rusty had been... according to a snippet, I won't read the whole thing out. He'd been in various bands and seen UMI and just was like in awe of them. And like I said previously, they were clearly going to be a good band, a fantastic band. They looked the part, they sounded the part. Everything was going for them. And Rusty was in a band in himself, but I don't think it worked out. And he was kind of given up on that dream, according to this. And I think he was working at a record label at the point. So I'll just bring it in from there. Then one day, the call, walking back into the office with a ham sandwich and a coffee in my hand, I was greeted by my boss with a confused look on his face and the phone in his hand. He said, "Tim Rogers is on the phone for you from New York." After some polite small talk and mention of a great bar called Jones, he cut to the chase. They were considering asking Mark to leave the band. And if so, would I be willing to perhaps take his place? I was shocked. I can't remember what I said, but stammering something in the affirmative, and he said, "Okay, mate, see you when we get back," as he turns the page in the little booklet. Ever the realist, my boss Dan counseled me not to get my hopes up too high. UMI had a drummer, and for all I knew, the whole thing would be patched up, and I would be returned to where I I don't know what this is saying. UMI had a drummer, and for all I knew, the whole thing would be patched up, and I would be returned to where they are. Oh, that's right. I get it. And I would be returned to the where they are now. I think we're going to have to. It's embarrassing.
Hey, come on.
I can't read.
So you can do it.
Thank you. UMI had a drummer, and for all I knew, the whole thing would be patched up, and I would be returned to the where are they now file. A few quotation marks would have been handy there.
Go on, Rusty.
Like anyone on the scene, we knew the fractious nature of UMI's relationship on and off stage and had seen the bust-ups firsthand. Also, like most people, I took it for the group's trademark passion boiling over into flying cymbals, fists, and guitars. It was one of the things that made them as great as they were. Besides, we agreed, Mark is a great drummer. And those are some very, very big shoes to fill. I thought he was right, of course. This is Dan, his boss. It was ludicrous to think I could step into the maelstrom. To be honest, I was completely racked with self-doubt. If it was true, how in the hell could I step up to the plate and actually be part of this group? I was older, a few more shows under my belt than those guys, but still, it was a big ask, and one I wasn't convinced I was up to. Then there was Mark, someone I'd known for a while, who I respected as a player, and knew that it would be controversial that he'd been replaced on the eve of the band's debut album. Duly, a tape arrived from Ruart Records. Mark was indeed out of the band, and there was an opportunity for me to hook up and play some songs with the guys. Early one morning at the office, I sat down before anyone else had shown up and placed it in the player. What I heard over the next 40 minutes or so solidified my resolve to be part of this incredible group. From the opening detuned blast of Coprolalia through jaw-dropping immediate obvious singles like Berlin Chair and Adam's Ribs to down-home goodness like Trainspotting and Rosedale, this was an album that was head and shoulders above every other group on the scene. Through majestic tracks like Forever and Easy and Everyone's to Blame, the song I always ask to do every time we go out on tour, into the wide open spaces of Jamie's Got a Girl, and then into the solitary and singular Ordinary, a song that confirmed my hunch that Tim was indeed a proper songwriter. I was stunned by the broken beauty and wordplay on display, by the near-perfect chiming guitars that drove along on top of a wonderfully supple rhythm section, and by the sheer magnificence of the sound that this three-piece produced. As the final chords of Sound As Ever rang out, I sat alone in the little office, stunned. Then I quietly whispered to myself, I'll do it. Sorry for my reading. I can't read. Holy shit. Anyway.
Well, that's illuminating. And I'd always, just because I knew that, read Rusty's bio and another Perth boy, I believe. But just played throughout tons of bands in the 80s and kind of like, I'd assumed he'd be more kind of like, but it sounds like he was excited and kind of daunted to enter the fold. And some useful extra context, especially kind of, he would have listened to this and be like, wow, this is kind of the world I'm entering. These are the songs that I'll be playing.
Yeah, exactly right. And so it gives you kind of context to those questions that you asked early on. So kind of how were they kind of seen in that scene? And it seemed like they had a lot of hype, at least at kind of the underground level, I guess, which is the only level that counts.
Scene respect, baby. That's what we do it for.
That's right.
And what do you know of in terms of how is this record commercially received, and what has kind of like, how is the passage of time? It seems like it's been favorable. I feel like with, you know, some, let's take the Vines, Highly Evolved, right? You could, that is going to forever define them. They could conceivably come out with, bad example because it's not really a band anymore, but like they could come out with an album that's objectively superior to that tomorrow and no one would give a shit. It's still Highly Evolved forever. And so I feel like with UMI, it's a little different. Early Daily, Hi-Fi Way will always be the kind of the heavier hitters. And I feel that helps a band in terms of the longevity of the debut record. Or it just makes you kind of, it's more kind of like a treasure trove. It's kind of like you allow, as opposed to like a classic, this album has to be perfect. You can kind of look back on it with fondness and be like, oh yeah, we were really young guys, as opposed to like, yeah, this debut album has become forever overplayed and we were constantly trying to live up to those expectations. So it's just a bunch of diatribe. What do you feel like, or what do you know about how it was received at the time commercially? And then, well, what do you feel like the reception over time, at least internally and externally, has been?
Yeah, well, I couldn't find where it sort of entered the charts or anything. The only reference I could find was that it was in the top 100. So it wasn't like a breakthrough from like a mainstream perspective. And obviously they had subsequent number one hits from Ali Daly through to number four record. But I think the way it's looked at now, and I'm really proud we haven't used this word throughout this whole podcast, but it's seen as like raw. You know, whenever you hear Sound As Ever, people go, oh, it's raw. And so I think that's how kind of people see it, as in it's a bit, it's imperfect, but really lovable, and, you know, obviously has an edge to it, and is of its time. And so I think it ended up winning an ARIA maybe for best independent release, or at least it was nominated. So I think it definitely signaled that there was much more coming from this band, and I think people were pretty excited by it, people in the know. So, and clearly, you know, the way the record industry works, from what I understand, they probably sort of put the wheels in motion to get ready for the next release, which turned out to be Hi-Fi Way.
Exciting stuff. The beginning of a very special journey. Let's do gold, silver, bronze in terms of the tracks. Silver,
bronze. Holy moly. You did say this before, but I totally forgot. Okay.
I'll give you some time. I'll do a few jazz hands and a little twirl up here so you can think. But I would go gold. Let's go the other way around for a little bit of intrigue and mystery. So I'd start with bronze. I'd say Sound as Ever would be my bronze. My silver would be Berlin Chair, and my gold would be Adam's Ribs. The Montreal Memories. So I'm glad we share them to this absolutely. Day. And that's a track that I feel like it's for me at least hits me in all the right spots. So that would be my podium. How about yourself? Mm.
Oh boy, this is so hard. I'm gonna regret it. That's the only thing I'm certain of. I'm gonna regret whatever I say. But let's start with bronze. I'm going to go Rosedale, number five, track number five, Rosedale. Silver. Silver, I'm going to go Coprolalia.
Yep. Incredible. Strong.
Start to the record. And gold. I think I'm going to have to go Everyone's to Blame.
Yeah, wow.
That's, I think, just the way... You know, this will change obviously over time, but as on this
right
date
now.
In late August or early September, whenever we are in 2022, Everyone's to Blame is my favorite track on Sound as Ever. Yes, I've left out Berlin Chair. Yes, I've left out Adam's Ribs. I already feel bad about it. Please don't at me. Is that a thing? Do people still at?
No, they need your at to at you. That's true. That's how it works. But, I feel like you're forever the company man here. You're trying to look at me. I've gone straight. I'm still very much a fan. I've got lots of learning to do. Went for two of the singles here, and you've gone like, no, this guy's been working hard over here. He deserves a promotion, and so I feel like no, no one's gonna let's face this. We're the only ones who care about these particular rankings. Maybe they'll change over time. Maybe in episode two, if you feel like before we begin, I need to make a change to my last podium.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's perfectly fine. This is podcasting, man. We can do whatever the fuck we want.
Yeah.
We can do whatever we want.
No rules.
All right. I think we did it. Episode one in the can. All right. So, this is an interesting situation because we've recorded this. This is pretty much a pilot episode. I'm pretty certain when this is out, you're going to have the ability to subscribe to the pod. We'll have links, what those links will look like. I don't fucking know, but they'll probably all involve ways in which you can kind of follow along and come along with us on this journey. So thanks for taking the time to listen to myself and Jono. And episode two, Hi-Fi Way, dropping soon. Thanks for your time, buddy.
Thanks, Tommy. Thanks, all. Chat soon.